Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Nastasia Lawton-Stickler of the Climate Disobedience Center, who talks about the Call to Courage campaign proactively responding to Donald Trump's possible future invocation of the Insurrection Act and suppression of dissent. Kiko Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center, who spoke at a recent New Haven, Connecticut protest rally in opposition to a Velo Airlines contract to fly deportation flights for the Trump administration. And Sam Rosenthal, political director of RootsAction.org, who discusses his group's petition calling on the Democratic National Committee to convene an emergency meeting to respond to Trump's authoritarian coup. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over the past several months, more than 200 Syrian civilians have been killed by landmines and unexploded munitions, remnants of that nation's civil war. The overthrow of former dictator Bashar al-Assad last December has led to 1.2 million Syrians returning home. But many cities, homes, and farms are littered with lethal landmines left by the Syrian army and other warring parties. Human rights groups are now calling for Syria's interim government to make removing landmines a top priority. Children are often victims of unexploded ordnance, especially brightly colored cluster bombs, which can be mistaken for toys. By mid-March, 640 civilians were reported killed or injured by landmines. An earlier United Nations estimate claimed one-third of the victims were children. Syrian Civil Defense, the internationally funded group known as the White Helmets, says it will take decades to deactivate all the landmines and other munitions. Many volunteer mine removers have risked their lives to neutralize mines from homes and farms. Volunteers have been helping to try to clear people's land to make it safe for them to return, but tragically, many of them have also been losing their own lives as a consequence. U.S. citizen George Glesman was released by the Taliban in Afghanistan on March 20th, after 2 years in captivity. His release came after the first known visit by U.S. officials to Kabul since 2021, when the nation fell to the Taliban insurgency. Soon after Glesman's release, Afghan officials announced that the U.S. had lifted bounties on three Taliban leaders who were members of a faction called the Haqqani Network, which Washington had long designated as a terrorist group for its targeting of U.S. troops during America's 20-year counterinsurgency war in the country. The Trump administration appears to be open to future negotiations in order to gain the release of remaining captive U.S. citizens, the return of U.S.-made weapons, and cooperation in targeting the ISIS faction based in Afghanistan. If future talks take place, the Taliban's objectives include the return of Afghan detainees held at the U.S. Guantanamo prison in Cuba, the lifting of bounties, providing financial assistance, and the easing of sanctions. The thawing of U.S.-Afghan relations comes as both China and Iran have begun engaging with the Taliban leadership. The Trump administration is limiting prosecution of cryptocurrency-related crimes and is disbanding a key task force at the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Cryptocurrency Enforcement Team, which was active under the Biden administration. This is more evidence of the Trump regime backing off on white-collar criminal investigations. Crypto executives were some of the Trump campaign's biggest contributors, many of whom had been publicly critical of Biden administration enforcement actions after the implosion of the fraudulent cryptocurrency exchange FTX, which cost consumer depositors over $8 billion. Trump's Department of Justice won't be pursuing litigation against crypto companies accused of violating securities, commodities, or banking secrecy laws that were used to prosecute and convict three founders of the cryptocurrency exchange BitMEX in 2022. Trump issued pardons to all three who were convicted. Meanwhile, in what many financial industry observers see as a clear conflict of interest, the President and First Lady Melania Trump have begun selling their own meme coins as Trump and his sons announced the launch of World Liberty Financial, another crypto venture. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Soon after being sworn into his second term as president, Donald Trump signed an executive order declaring an emergency at the U.S. southern border and directed administration officials to evaluate whether or not to recommend the invocation of the rarely used Insurrection Act of 1807. The Insurrection Act permits a president to deploy the military inside the U.S. to enforce the law or put down a rebellion. Although there are reports that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem will not be recommending invocation of the Insurrection Act at this time due to the reduced number of migrant border crossings, their report to the president has not yet been made public. To place the current debate in context, Trump's first-term Defense Secretary Mark Esper recounted in his memoir that Trump was enraged when he, Esper, publicly opposed invoking the Insurrection Act in June 2020. As Black Lives Matter protesters gathered in Washington, D.C. after the death of George Floyd, Trump reportedly asked Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley in a June 2020 White House meeting, quote, "Can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something," unquote. Your reporter spoke with Nastasia Lawton-Stickler, an organizer with the Climate Disobedience Center, who discusses her group's distribution of information about the Call to Courage campaign, an effort to reach out to military personnel to not comply with unlawful and unconstitutional presidential orders, amid concern that if Trump invokes the Insurrection Act, he could abuse that power to target protesters and use state violence to suppress dissent.
The language of the Insurrection Act is that the military can be called up to, quote, address an insurrection in any state, which makes it impracticable to carry out state law. And so that language is really vague, and it never really defines what kind of crisis, what scale of crisis warrants calling up the military to enforce civil law. I think the fear is that while the proclamation contained the invocation of Insurrection Act to the southern border, there really are no guardrails around what other quote-unquote crises this administration deems necessary to invoke the Insurrection Act. So, you know, the fear is that with those guardrails out of place, the Insurrection Act could be invoked to quell protests to any of the ICE abductions that have been happening, or solidarity with Palestinian people, or protests to the fossil fuel industry, which is very obviously being propped up by this administration. So the vagueness of the language and the moral corruptness of this administration, I think, give us reason to be extremely concerned that if this act were to be invoked, there's no telling where it would stop in the enforcement of civil law by our military.
Are there any roadblocks to a president, Donald Trump or any other president, from invoking the Insurrection Act? For instance, could federal courts or the U.S. Supreme Court get involved in a declaration of an emergency of that gravity that, in the mind of a president like Trump, could justify all sorts of repression of peaceful protests, let alone suspension of the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution?
That's a great question, to which I don't have a good legal answer, but We have been seeing in other areas, most notably in the abductions that ICE has been carrying out recently, that even in cases where the courts have found the actions of the administration to be unlawful or unconstitutional, one, that process takes time. It takes time to make its way through the court system, even up to the Supreme Court. And two, there really isn't any reason to be assured at this point that the administration is even going to follow court orders. We've seen time and again that the administration is ignoring orders from circuit courts and even the Supreme Court in the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who's being held unlawfully in El Salvador, that the administration is both dragging its feet and using any excuse it can to not follow the orders of the court. So I do imagine that there are legal avenues to be able to challenge that. It's not clear whether or not those legal avenues are actually going to put a stop to what the administration is carrying out.
Especially in view of the really extremist supermajority that now sits on the U.S. Supreme Court.
So. Yes, exactly.
Nastassja, tell our listeners about the Call of the Courage campaign. It's really pivoted on the Article 90 and 92 of the U.S. Military Code, which gives a soldier the right to disobey an illegal order violating the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, so we sent out this campaign. We shared it with our networks. It's not a Climate Disobedience Center campaign, but one that has been built by lots of different organizers, community members, and we felt that it was really important to share. So the basis of the campaign really at its heart is about relationship building, which I think is the foundation of any kind of successful organizing that we want to do. So it encourages and gives folks a roadmap to learn a little bit more about military code and the ways in which military folks are protected from carrying out illegal orders. And it also encourages people to form relationships with people, to talk to people face to face. The sort of tagline of the project is, please don't turn on us. And it's really about humanizing ourselves to our military neighbors, humanizing them, and building a structure of relationship and support that makes it a lot harder to be turned against each other should something like the Insurrection Act come into play.
Nastassja, how are organizers of this Call to Courage campaign doing outreach and education of soldiers, advising them of their rights to disobey direct orders in the event those orders are deemed to be unlawful or unconstitutional?
Yeah, so folks have been going right to military bases to the extent that they're able to approach them. They have had conversations with military personnel. Military personnel are not allowed to take flyers from anyone while they're on duty, but they have been able to take photographs of the resource that people are taking with them. It is a link tree that has a lot of categories of resources. So people have been doing that, have been showing up to bases. People have been talking with friends and family who are in the military. Veterans have been really on the forefront of this work, both sort of having the knowledge and experience of having been in the military, as well as organizing experience. So people have just been trying to make inroads wherever they can and build humanizing relationships wherever they can, whether it's by just showing up at a base that is near where they live or talking to people that they already have relationships with who are in the military.
That was Nastassja Lawton-Stickler, an organizer with the Climate Disobedience Center. Learn more about the Call to Courage campaign and news related to the Insurrection Act by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Avelo Airlines, a budget carrier offering low fares to a growing number of U.S. cities in Puerto Rico, recently announced that it had signed a contract with the Trump administration's Department of Homeland Security to fly deportation flights out of Mesa, Arizona, that will begin on May 12th. One of Avelo's two transit hubs is New Haven, Connecticut's Tweed Airport, which 2 years ago welcomed the airline and awarded the company a state subsidy on jet fuel. New Haven, which considers itself a welcoming city, with protections in place for undocumented immigrants, reacted with fury. New Haven's Mayor Justin Elliker, Connecticut Attorney General William Tong, and local immigrant rights advocacy groups have all condemned Avelo's deportation contract. An online boycott of the airline has collected over 34,000 signatures. Avelo's CEO Andrew Levy responded to the controversy by stating his airline had also flown deportation flights for the Biden administration. Since Avelo's government contract was made public, two large rallies have been organized at New Haven's Tweed Airport, calling on the company to drop its deportation business. Protests have also spread to at least four other airports in Wilmington, Delaware, Rochester, New York, Salem, Willamette, Oregon, and Burbank, California. Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center and a New Haven resident, spoke at the April 17th Tweed protest, which was recorded by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus.
It's been 4 years since Avelo announced that it would be setting up shop in New Haven. Public officials rolled out the red carpet. We welcomed them. We gave them tax breaks, right? We even said that we were going to support them by upgrading the airport infrastructure. 4 years is a long time, right? How many of you remember what the hell you were doing 4 years ago? Right, you don't. So in the 4 years that this airline has been here, you would think that its leadership would have done its homework and taken time to learn about New Haven, our city, and our values. Have they done that?
No!
Have they done that?
No!
Are we going to teach them about our values?
Yes!
I'm going to share my top four things that I want Avelo to know about New Haven and our values, and feel free to add on to that during this rally. The first thing I want Avelo to know is that we are a welcoming city. Are we a welcoming city?
Yes!
We have a rich and proud history of welcoming immigrants and refugees. So much so that we are recognized nationally as a cutting-edge city with amazing policies that others around the nation have copied. So Avelo, take note. The second thing that I want Avelo to know is that we have a track record of protecting immigrants when ICE has come to town.
Yes, we do.
Do we?
Yeah.
Every time ICE has come to town to break doors down and drag our immigrant brothers and sisters out and arrest them and detain them, what have we done? We have kicked them out of town.
Yes.
Are we going to continue to do that?
Yes.
Will we ever be complicit?
No.
We will never be complicit, and neither should Avelo.
Yes.
The third thing, and I know that we've got some public officials here, the third thing that I want Avelo to know is that every single time that our public officials have gotten behind us and coalesced around immigrant rights, guess what? We have won.
Yeah.
Whether it was the ID card fight, whether it was the raids of 2007, or efforts to protect immigrants in sanctuaries, we fought and we won every one of those fights. And guess what? We are gonna win this fight as well.
Yeah.
And finally, this is my favorite one because I see myself on this one. This is also what I want Avelo to know, which is that our activists, we are a bunch of stubborn badasses. We are relentless. We are stubborn. And you know how I know? Because I'm one of them. We will not back down. We will not be dissuaded. We are going to organize, organize, organize. We're going to fight. And we're gonna win. Who's with me?
Yeah.
We will not give up until each and every one of our demands are met. This campaign is now national in scope. So what should Avelo expect? They should expect more pressure, more attention. Avelo, listen, escúchame. It's never too late. History is watching. Do the right thing. Se puede.
Yeah.
Se puede.
That was Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center, speaking at a protest against Avelo Airlines' contract to fly deportation flights for the Trump administration's Department of Homeland Security. Learn more about opposition to Avelo's deportation flights and the boycott campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A growing number of Americans are worried about the future of the country. There's concern about Wall Street's worst April performance since the 1932 Depression era in response to Donald Trump's imposition of indiscriminate international tariffs, the dismantling of the Social Security system, congressional Republicans' plan to defund Medicaid, the illegal deportation of U.S. residents without due process, and a mafia-like extortion scheme targeting universities, law firms, and the media. Amid rising fear and anger, it's not surprising to find that President Trump's approval rating edged down to its lowest level since his return to the White House. An April 9th Quinnipiac University poll found Trump had a 53% unfavorable rating compared to 41% who had a favorable view. At the same time, Democratic Party leaders have major problems. A Gallup poll released in mid-April found just 25% of respondents expressed confidence in Democratic congressional leadership, down 9 points from the previous historic low of 34% set in 2023. Progressive activist groups, RootsAction.org and Progressive Democrats for America, have recently launched a petition drive calling on the Democratic National Committee to convene an emergency meeting to develop a bold action plan to mobilize effective opposition to the unpopular autocratic agenda of Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and the Republican Party. Your reporter spoke with Sam Rosenthal, political director of RootsAction.org, who explains what he and other progressive activists are asking of the Democratic Party in response to the current constitutional crisis.
Generally, as a party, I think that there's this really apparent lack of coordinated strategy. And this is one of the reasons that we wanted to target the DNC instead of going after, individual members of the party or people who are in leadership, because we think it's the DNC's responsibility to be driving this strategy. One of the things that's most stunning and most galling, really, is that there appears to have been no strategy heading into the beginning of the Trump administration. It seemed like Democrats within the DNC and those in elected leadership were as surprised and stunned and bowled over as all the rest of us were, which the Trump administration has pursued a very aggressive tack. So I get that somewhat, but it appeared that there had been no preparatory conversations, that the Democrats didn't have a strategy for what they would do if Trump moved to the most excessive, the most authoritarian, the rightmost extreme, which is what he's done. And so I think that's really disturbing. Overall, it's a really, really disappointing isn't even a strong enough word, but it's a really shockingly incommensurate response. I think there have been some bright spots. We've been happy to see that Bernie Sanders and AOC, that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have been on this sort of barnstorming tour. They've been drawing these huge crowds. It's clear that there's still really an appetite for progressive politics. And I think taking a message directly to voters has been really good. We've also seen some other Democrats who are holding town halls in red districts or purple districts where Republicans are too afraid to meet with their constituents because they know that what's happening at the federal level is so unpopular. People like Ro Khanna, who have been going into purple districts near his own to talk to voters there. I think that's a really good effort, one that I'd like to see happening in many more parts of the country. And then, I think in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a better response on the horrendous racist immigration policies that we've seen from the Trump administration. You had Senator Van Hollen traveling down to El Salvador. I think that was a good move, something that directly was a finger in the eye of the Trump administration and also was an urgent humanitarian mission. And so there are some moves that, you know, we see that seem like they're invigorating the Democratic Party's base, that are sort of responding to what Democrats are seeing in the streets. But still, the gulf between what the base clearly wants from the party, the level of activity the base wants from the party, and what those at the DNC and inside Congress are willing to do is really vast. And so we really want to see that gulf close. We want to see Democratic leadership meet the energy and enthusiasm that the base has for fighting Trump and Trumpism.
Well, Sam, how's the campaign going in terms of the Democratic National Committee's response to your call for an emergency meeting to really strategize and develop tactics to challenge the Trump administration's attack on democracy?
Yeah, we haven't gotten an official response from the DNC yet. You'll be surprised to hear. They have a regularly scheduled meeting coming up at the end of the summer. And so I guess they think that that's okay to, you know, kick the can down the road a few more months and just sort of let Trump do whatever he wants during that period. But we've heard a lot of positive feedback from grassroots activists, even from some people in the party who, you know, sort of off the record will send us a note or send us a text saying, this is a good campaign, we approve of this initiative. But you won't see anyone publicly stepping out of line against the party right now. At the same time, you know, they could decide to convene a party meeting at any moment. They can do it virtually. You know, it's well within the power of the elected leadership to do this. So the ball is really in their court. And we hope that, you know, folks who are listening, who are curious about the campaign, who are, you know, involved in grassroots activism, well, think about contacting the DNC and telling them, you know, I heard about this idea. I think it's a really good one. And I hope that you take it seriously and that you try to convene a meeting much earlier than the regularly scheduled one at the end of the summer.
That was Sam Rosenthal, political director of RootsAction.org. Learn more about his group's petition calling on the DNC to convene an emergency meeting by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, KIDE in Hoopa, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.